Okay, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Sleary Report. It is my pleasure to welcome someone who I've been in cahoots with for years, and I have always wanted to get her on the Sleary Report on several different topics. Her name is Dr. Meryl Ness. I'm sure you've seen her republished and linked to on the Sleary Report. She is one of the most remarkable experts in the country on the history, not just of vaccines, but of the regulatory complexity of Washington and regulation in this area. And it started, I think, with the anthrax vaccine. She is a practicing physician in Maine. And I dare say, Dr. Ness, when you, I'll just call you Meryl, when you decided to first look into what the FDA was doing with respect to different vaccines, it never occurred to you that you would become the leading expert in the country on these issues. Is that fair to say?
Well, I would say it's kind of pathetic because I'm not a lawyer. I don't know law, and I don't know how to understand everything that's gone on. And it's pathetic because there are so few people who are explaining to the public what has happened to us in terms of emergency regulations and the regulation of drugs and vaccines, you know, by the FDA during this pandemic emergency. So that's I tried to talk a lawyer into looking into all the emergency. There are many emergency laws.
Uh-huh.
And most of them came into being after the anthrax letters as a mechanism for dealing with either bioterrorism or pandemics. There had been a lot of what I would call sort of a fake drumbeat about, you know, it's not a question of if, it's just a question of when. We're going to have a terrible flu pandemic at some point. We're going to have bioterrorism. We have to get ready. We have to spend a lot of money. And since 9/11, the United States has been spending roughly $7 billion a year. To develop responses to bioterrorism and pandemics. But a lot of the money wasn't spent for useful things, as you can see. Now, when we finally had the pandemic, we had nothing. We didn't even have PPE. We didn't have masks, let alone drugs, vaccines, et cetera. So where did that money go? What has this all been about? You know, a lot. We need many people looking into this.
So I have to tell you, when the Comirnaty, I'm going to mispronounce it, vaccine was approved by the FDA, except it was not going to be available in the United States. I read the decision. It was many pages, and I read the decision. I was driving back from a meeting in the Netherlands with one of my partners. I read the decision like four or five times, and at the end of it, I said, you know, I cannot understand a word of this. We have to call Meryl Ness. And it seemed, you know, because you were churning it out on at your website, it's Anthrax Vaccine Blogspot, and you were the one who explained to all of us exactly what this all meant, because it's the games and the tricks are so complex. Anyway, so let's dive in. Anyway, you have a long history as a physician in Maine. You have a long history dealing with the sort of the games in and around medicine and the legal and regulatory issues. But let's step back and talk about you as a physician and your medical practice first. Tell us the sort of the history. You've had a long, successful medical practice. And I know because on the rare occasions I've talked to some of your patients, they just adore you.
Well, I'm an internal medicine physician, and I've often worked for hospitals and done emergency room work, ICU, you know, inpatient and outpatient. Haven't done a huge amount of general internal medicine as an outpatient. I sort of got more interested in complicated disorders and things that other doctors couldn't treat or didn't want to treat. And I came to let me go back 32 years. Okay, I'm a young doctor. I go to the wrong meeting and I wind up agreeing to investigate a particular professor at UMass who was doing research on anthrax vaccines. And it turned out he wasn't doing research on anthrax vaccines. He was doing genetic engineering of anthrax research for the Defense Department. And so when I found that out, I thought, geez, you know, nobody else is looking into this, so I better do it. And I looked at all the recent anthrax epidemics and discovered one that looked like it was due to biological warfare, but had been written off as a natural event. And that was the largest anthrax epidemic ever in Rhodesia during its civil war, 1978 to 81. And I also thought I needed to look into what he was doing with the Defense Department, you know, and it turned out he had misrepresented his research, and this program that he was working under, which was it's changed the name several times, so that name doesn't exist anymore. But anyway, they had a mission statement that you're not supposed to do the kind of work that he was doing. You're only supposed to do defensive work, nothing with offensive implications. So I wrote a paper about the offensive implications and how the Defense Department said they weren't going to do that, but they were. And then I spent 3 years studying the Rhodesian outbreak and was eventually able to show it was due to biological warfare.
Wow.
Almost immediately after I published that, at the same time, there was a peculiar epidemic in Cuba of blindness and peripheral neuropathy. And I was asked by someone to look into that, which I did, and I discovered, along with some other people working independently around the same time, that it was actually due to cyanide. And so I was invited to Cuba and to talk to people there about my work and how to, you know, try to fix the problem. But I learned that this outbreak had many features that were similar to chronic fatigue syndrome, and that it was due to a poisoning by cyanide of the mitochondrial energy producing system, which is called the electron transport chain. And I realized that chronic fatigue syndrome might well be, or in some cases anyway, be due to impaired mitochondrial function and energy production. It certainly was a very simple hypothesis, and it looked reasonable. And I came home and I said, I got to work on this. You know, this is really important. So I started, you know, researching it, and I decided I was going to start, you know, my own independent practice. And I would encourage patients with chronic fatigue syndrome to come to me and see if I could, and in that, in mostly with supplements and vitamins like B12, which B12 worked in the Cuban epidemic for a couple of reasons. But anyway, so I was interested in doing that, and I opened a practice here in Maine. And I didn't even realize at the time, but fibromyalgia was like way more prevalent than chronic fatigue syndrome. It was on the same sort of spectrum of symptoms. So people with fibromyalgia are also fatigued. They also have some brain fog, but they hurt a lot. And a lot of people with chronic fatigue syndrome also hurt, you know, but their primary problem is fatigue. And the fibromyalgia patients, their primary symptom was pain.
Right.
But they basically were on the same spectrum of symptoms. And then I found Gulf War syndrome was on that spectrum. And then a few years later, anthrax vaccine injuries were also on that same spectrum of illness. So that was quite extraordinary that here I was working on chronic fatigue syndrome, and I'm also working on trying to stop the mandates for anthrax vaccine in the military. And then they wind up having the same disease that I'm studying. So there are a lot of, you know, I don't know, good coincidences or bad, but it sort of pushed me into this realm of being very intensely interested in the whole anthrax vaccine issue, as well as the symptoms that develop after these kind of injuries. There are other conditions. So Lyme disease caused similar symptoms. Sick building syndrome. So if you were in a building that was too tight and you were inhaling too many volatile organic compounds that were toxic, you might get the same thing. So anyway,
the way my simple mind thinks of it is you are a doctor who's been trying to help people struggling with what I call the great poisoning.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
That's true. I didn't see it that way for a long time, but
no, who could believe that you would see it the way we now see it? Right.
Yeah.
Right. And you know, part of that is struggling with the regulatory bureaucracy and the Washington bureaucracy trying to get it to understand and respond. Of course, now that we've read Bobby's book on Fauci, we realize that was, you know, we were up against it. Okay, so have been helping a lot of people for the last 2 years understand what's going on. You've worked closely with Children's Health Defense. You're on the European Advisory Board. You're very close in helping in many respects. But you also continued your practice, and lo and behold, you've run smack into the Maine Health Board. Tell us about it.
Yes. So being someone who knows about biological warfare and knows about pandemics, when this pandemic started, of course, I got very, first of all, the government wasn't responding correctly, right? They weren't telling us what to do. They weren't providing tests. They still haven't provided high quality tests. They still don't tell us how well any of the tests work. None of them have been actually licensed by the FDA. So I started trying to sort of pare down my medical practice and spend more and more of my time studying the pandemic, what is really going on. And initially I was writing and trying to tell people how to protect yourself, you know, what drugs might work, how to clean your vegetables, all sorts of things like that.
Right.
What kind of masks might be useful. But by the end of March, I had discovered that there was a cover-up going on regarding the origin of the pandemic. And then I started realizing there's really some, they're not just incompetent. There's more to it than, you know, entrenched incompetence, and which we don't want to, you know, we don't want to minimize that because there's a lot of incompetence in Washington and turgor. Right. So I started looking more into the origins and wrote a few little, you know, blog posts and short papers about that. Because I'm good at, I think my talent is identifying bullshit and propaganda. You know, it speaks to me right away, so I can identify it and dissect it. And then I had a strong background in the hydroxychloroquine and chloroquine drugs, much more so than most doctors. I'd spent 6 months in Africa. I'd taken chloroquine for those whole 6 months. I eventually got malaria. You know, I'd used it for treatment. I'd even overdose myself on it. This was when I was very young, before I went to med school. And then the hydroxychloroquine I had used for patients with rheumatoid arthritis and lupus. And it turns out that it's a very good drug in combination with azithromycin or a similar macrolid antibiotic for Lyme disease. And I have been like a Lyme doctor in my area. My county at times has had the highest rate of Lyme disease of any county in the country.
Really? I didn't know that.
Yeah. So at times. And right. So we have a lot of Lyme disease here on the coast of Maine. And so I have treated, you know, probably about 1,000 patients with Lyme disease over the years. Almost everybody around here has had Lyme disease at least once.
Right.
And the dogs have all had it. So I'd treated, you know, probably at least a couple of hundred people with hydroxychloroquine in combination for Lyme disease. So I was familiar with the drug. I knew it was a safe drug and I knew how to use it. And I couldn't understand why we weren't using it for COVID when the Chinese were recommending it and we didn't have anything else. So I started looking into that and I wrote a very, a long blog post about the ways that chloroquine and hydroxychloroquine use were suppressed by governments by manufacturers of generic or brand versions, by countries, by pharmacy chains, by a lot of other entities. I mean, in such an extraordinarily comprehensive and coordinated fashion that it's actually too much to believe.
Right.
And you have to read.
Right, especially because in many places in the world, it was an over-the-counter drug.
Absolutely. Right. Absolutely. And still is in some places, but not everywhere. So the blog post eventually had 58 different ways in which these drugs were suppressed. 58. I mean, it's really remarkable. And there's links, you know, I've provided links so everybody can look up what happened. And then once you see that, you realize we're dealing with an international coordinated event to suppress the use of effective treatment for COVID. And this was, you know, when I first published that, it was in June of 2020.
Right.
And I had also, other people had identified the overdose potential of hydroxychloroquine in the recovery trial in the UK, which was their very large trial of drugs for COVID. And then I started looking at other trials and found that there were several other trials that were also overdosing patients with the same dose, which was a borderline lethal dose, potentially lethal, especially if you're on certain other medications, if you didn't weigh very much, or if you had significant other comorbidities, you could have a cardiac arrhythmia as a result of taking it at those doses, which were several times, like roughly three times the normal dose.
Right.
So having pieced that together, I then realized we're in a, basically a world takeover situation.
We're in a war. This is a
yes.
war. Right. Right.
Yes. So.
Did you realize that withholding these treatments was part and parcel of achieving an emergency use authorization on a vaccine?
Yes and no, because see, the FDA is lawless. And so even when these drugs are available, you know, they're denying that they work.
Right.
So I do think that the suppression may well have had to do with the requirements to issue an emergency use authorization, but other requirements were not met. So, for example, you're required to tell people the known risks and benefits of the vaccine, but FDA is not doing that.
Right.
So, however, both hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin are extremely long-acting drugs with a biological half-life, probably of a month or more. Mm-hmm. And that means they can be used like vaccines as a preventive, in addition to being used to acutely treat COVID.
Right.
Now, in a number of states, including my own, the governor or other officials at the state level issued restrictions on the drug back in March of 2020.
Wow. So this was all geared.
Yes, this was planned ahead of time, if they needed to do it, because it happened in over 30 states almost simultaneously. And in my state, the restriction was that you could not use hydroxychloroquine for prevention, only for, but you were allowed to for treatment. In New York, you were not, the governor issued a proclamation that you couldn't use it for outpatients. You'd only use it for inpatients, which was, by the time you became an inpatient, it was too late, didn't work anymore.
Right.
And in New Jersey, the Consumer Affairs Bureau issued some rule or something that you could only get a prescription if you had a positive test.
Wow.
Yeah. So there are all these different mechanisms that came into play at that time. And this was right around the time Trump said the drug, you know, was likely to work. Now, before Trump said that, I had been reading the literature from China, and I knew that it was likely. I was really excited because I know this drug. This is, you know, this is pretty safe, you know, this is good. We can make short shrift of this pandemic if it really works. And then Trump said a few things, and that was the end of it. And then people started coming up to me and saying, boy, I hope Trump doesn't say anything about ivermectin.
But when, now you were using it during the, what were you doing during this period in terms of using ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine in your practice?
So I was, so luckily we didn't have a lot of COVID. I was prohibited from using it prophylactically. So I was using it in patients for acute COVID. At that time, I didn't know about ivermectin. I only found out about ivermectin late in 2020. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't sure. I had never used that drug before. So it wasn't until I saw Pierre Corey, and you know, who was, that was on December 8th, I believe, 2020, talk about it. And I said, this guy, I remember writing a blog post and saying, I do not believe this man is lying. I believe this stuff
works.
Yeah,
I remember seeing that. He was so forceful, so clear. It was a very good presentation. I remember that. Yeah.
And then it was knocked off YouTube.
Of course. That's how you probably knew the drug worked.
Right, exactly.
Right, right.
So I started using that. And there were no restrictions on ivermectin. So it could potentially be used prophylactically or acutely. However, 2 weeks after Pierre Corey gave that impassioned speech, and other people also talked about ivermectin at Ron Johnson's hearing, and this was right before Ron Johnson lost his chairmanship. So it was like the end of what he was able to do at that point. South Africa banned the importation of ivermectin on Christmas Eve.
Wow. But that got overturned, right?
It got overturned in the courts, but it took a few months.
Right.
And so I thought, uh-oh, this is the trial balloon. They're going to, you know, and I've been thinking, they may do what, to ivermectin what they did to hydroxychloroquine. And so I encourage patients, do not take it prophylactically. Take it acutely, because you don't know when they're going to take, you know, get rid of the supply. And right now I can actually write you a prescription that you can have ahead of time. Because we right. don't know if you're going to be able to get it later.
Right.
So I was giving out, you know, prescriptions in advance, as well as treating people acutely.
Right. Right. Okay. So you just got an action from your medical board. Tell us what happened.
Yeah. So this is another coordinated assault on the practice of medicine.
Right.
Happened in the end of July, an organization that hardly anyone knew existed called the Federation of State Medical Boards, which is a nonprofit membership organization of medical licensing boards whose sole purpose, as far as I knew, up until that time, was to provide the boards with training, with policy recommendations, you know, with basically administrative assistance for their jobs. The medical boards are state agencies with volunteer physicians and other medical professionals on them, whose job is to basically take away the licenses of medical professionals with substance abuse problems or sexual abuse of patient problems. That's pretty much what they do. I guess if you develop dementia and you still want to practice, they can, you know, take away your license also. And one of the things they do is remediation. So they can recommend counseling if you have these problems. So had I been, you know, a drug addict or an alcoholic, they would have recommended counseling and treatment. But what the Federation of State Medical Boards did out of the blue in July was to tell all its member boards to start threatening, it threatened doctors, and it told them to threaten doctors that they shouldn't say any negative things about vaccines. They should not prescribe ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine, which were not authorized or approved by the FDA for the treatment of COVID, and that they must stop spreading misinformation and disinformation. Now, And immediately after this came out of the Federation of State Medical Boards, which, by the way, has no regulatory authority, has no right to come up with any of this, the American Medical Association, the American Pharmacy Association, the American Association of Hospital Pharmacists, and several of the specialty boards like internal medicine, pediatrics, family practice boards, which are all nonprofit organizations whose CEOs earn about $1 million or more a year. Most of them have their own foundations, and they're supposed to serve the doctors, not threaten the doctors. They're supposed to provide help. They're membership organizations of physicians. But what's the truth about behind these organizations? They get most of their money not from dues, from pharma.
Right.
And from CDC and from entities like that. So in concert, they all started saying, yes, we have to go after the licenses of doctors who spread misinformation and use these drugs. And then a couple
so
of
can new- I just point out that ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine are very economic and inexpensive. Whereas if they're successful, that dramatically reduces the profits coming from much more profitable vaccines and other treatments. So, and the treatments required by the adverse events from the vaccine. So you're talking about a dramatic swing in pharmaceutical company profits here.
So there's two things. So in the third world, you can get a course of ivermectin or hydroxychloroquine for under a dollar.
Right.
Whereas monoclonal antibodies in the U.S. are about $3,000 per person. The Paxlovid drug is about $500 or $600 per person. The Merck drug is, I think, about $700. And remdesivir, you have to get IV for usually 5 days. So you're looking at several thousand dollars plus your hospital stay for that. So huge disparity in cost. But the other thing is, if you had used these drugs, probably, and they were given early at the beginning of the illness, you would have almost no long COVID. You would have almost no deaths, almost no hospitalizations, and the pandemic would go away because you would not be infectious, contagious for as long.
Right.
And if you use the drugs prophylactically, you might wipe things out even quicker.
Right.
So I think all of those, and of course, you wouldn't have needed dangerous vaccines. So I think all of those things fed into the suppression.
Right. I'll never forget one of the videos that really impressed me. I don't know if you saw it, was Dr. Zelenko was testifying to the rabbinical board in Jerusalem. And one of them at the end felt badly about sort of how the conversation had gone and thanked him for his protocols, and I think they had used hydroxychloroquine or whatever, but to heal themselves. And Zelenko goes ballistic and says, how dare you use something you're denying to the people? He just, I don't know if you've seen it, but
I did not see that. Yeah. But it's absolutely a critical thing because, as Pierre Corey has said, many members of Congress, like over 100, have used these drugs and yet have made no effort to open them up to the public.
Well, to me, this is criminal. This is criminal. Yeah, this is just criminal. And it's appalling and shocking to see the extent of the inability so far of the system to turn things around. Now, from looking, so let's keep going with what the main board did.
Well, let me go back and just say all these organizations together, which must have been paid off to do this. So if you want to suppress these drugs, you also have to go after misinformation and disinformation because you can't have people talking about the drugs either, right?
Right.
You have to. And eventually when they did their best to suppress them, but some people are still able to obtain these drugs, then I think a decision was made, we have to suppress the doctors. Because if we can control the doctors, nobody will be able to get a prescription.
Right.
And that's how we'll do it. The drugs are still licensed.
Unless they go to their vets.
Right. Well, even though some of the farm stores are not carrying ivermectin anymore.
Right.
So anyway, so the board of Federation of State Medicals told its 71 members, go after doctors. And new NGOs suddenly popped up whose only purpose was to take away the licenses of doctors who spread information and use these so-called, you know, ineffective drugs for COVID.
Right.
And about somewhere between 12 and 15 boards went with the FSMB and started going after doctors for misinformation and using these drugs. So 15 out of 71. The rest presumably had lawyers who were competent on their staffs and said, wait a minute, this is we're abrogating the First Amendment here. We're not allowed to do that. The Constitution is extremely clear on this subject. And by the way, these are licensed drugs. They don't have to be authorized or approved for COVID. You're just doing off-label prescribing, which is somewhere between 10 and 40% of all prescriptions in the United States. So
right.
Drug, legal to dispense, et cetera. What had also happened is that the boards of pharmacy, so the boards of medicine were trying to scare some of them, trying to scare the doctors, and the boards of pharmacy were trying to scare the pharmacists into not dispensing. So by the time the fall came around in Maine, I could hardly find a pharmacy to dispense and either of the drugs. The ivermectin can be compounded, so they can buy, compounding pharmacies can buy ivermectin powder and put it in capsules. So the compounders, who are very familiar with the law because they've had a lot more restrictions put on them, they knew this was legal and they kept supplying it, ivermectin. But you can't compound hydroxychloroquine. You just have to buy the pill. So I had only one pharmacist I was sure of who would dispense hydroxychloroquine in the whole state. And anyway, so I had a So the board, not only the board, but the governor had initially issued this restriction on hydroxychloroquine. And the way it played out was that you had to write, unlike for other prescriptions, you had to write on the hydroxychloroquine prescriptions what it's for. You had to say COVID, and which gives the pharmacist privileged medical information that they shouldn't have according to other laws. But of course, we're ignoring a lot of laws. And I didn't, so I had a patient who needed it. He needed it very much. I called a pharmacy that I expected would likely not fill the prescription, but I just didn't say what it was for, you know, as if it was for something else, which could have been. And but the pharmacist called me and said, what's it for? And I said, if I knew that if I said COVID, he wouldn't dispense it. So I said it was for Lyme disease, and he dispensed it. The patient got it. And I immediately contacted the Board of Medicine in Maine and said, look what you and the Board of Pharmacy have forced me to do. This is a legal drug. I should be able to prescribe it. It should be dispensed, you know, but you've stopped that from happening. And so I had to tell a white lie to a pharmacist in order to get this drug for a extremely high risk patient who absolutely needed it. And instead of responding in an appropriate, and I said, look, can't we just get back to taking care of patients instead of playing these games? Because it was, the game was that they had never written, neither of these boards had written down on paper what pharmacists could and could not do.
Wow.
So what they had done instead was sent, the Board of Pharmacy had sent a memo in September saying, ivermectin has to be prescribed for legitimate purposes to all the pharmacies. And CDC had sent out an emergency memo at the end of August to pharmacies and doctors saying there were two people who overdosed on non-prescription ivermectin. And therefore, you know, this is a big warning about it. And so what happened was neither of those documents formally restricted the dispensing or prescribing of ivermectin, but everybody knew what they really meant, which was don't you dare or you'll be investigated.
Right.
And that's when all the pharmacies stopped dispensing. And so I have pointed out that we are now, instead of being governed by the rule of law, we're governed by the rule of threats and innuendo. and right. you have to read between the lines.
Right.
And this is not how the United States should be doing business, and certainly not how the boards of medicine and pharmacy ought to be doing business.
Right.
So in my case, two people accused me to the board, one probably as an agent, and they said, we saw an interview of Dr. Ness online. We don't know who she is. We never met her, but she's spreading misinformation. And then two medical professionals reported me to the board, and one said, I had a patient who Dr. Ness treated with ivermectin, and that's horse paste, and she shouldn't be doing that. And the other one said, I have a patient who she treated with hydroxychloroquine, and she shouldn't be doing that. And so I'm reporting it. Neither one said the patient had suffered. Patients were happy. And so those four complaints, plus my own self-report regarding the white lie, it was the whole case against me. And I said to the board, look, you guys, you know, this is a First Amendment issue here. I said, where is the statute that says misinformation is a crime? How can you go after me when there's no law, there's no rule, there's no regulation, there is nothing except some stupid statement from the FSMB that you used and sent an email to doctors.
Right, but they also have no standing.
Right.
They have no legal regulatory legislative standing at all.
No. And they don't have the right to make new laws.
Right.
They don't have the right to create crimes. They have a wide berth of things they can do with doctors, but they're expected to go after them, you know, within a spectrum that has already been defined. So they didn't. It wasn't only me. They went after two other docs. They had never enshrined any of this into rules or regulations for themselves. And so basically they don't have a leg to stand on. And so why aren't more docs? So lots of doctors are having their licenses pulled. So another doctor in Maine also was suspended, and a third is undergoing a process now where they want to suspend him. The thing is, it costs a lot of money,
right,
to fight. That's what stops you. And you think, well, doctors have a lot of money. Well, we're talking hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Right.
And so the only reason I'm able to fight back is because Children's Health Defense and Bobby Kennedy said, we will support you. And not only that, we're not going to tell you how to run your defense. You can pick your attorney and you can run your own defense, and
good,
we'll support
them.
You.
So, good for them.
So, you know, that was huge. And
my understanding is you have been very helpful to people who are trying to figure out how to litigate. If there's anybody I would trust to figure out how to approach this and do it properly, I mean, you're a very, very thorough, careful person, you know, whenever you talk through one of these things with you. So I would think you would be quite... I would hate to be the attorney on the other side of you, Meryl, to be perfectly honest. You know, you look so sweet, but I would be afraid. No, really, if I was the attorney on the other side, I would be afraid.
Well, so my attorneys filed their first brief last week, and uh-huh. 3 days later, one of the board attorneys contacted them and said, I'm calling an emergency meeting of the board, and we will discuss the... psych evaluation that they ordered for him, because there was no grounds for it. They had no grounds at all for the psych evaluation.
So they've asked for a psych evaluation, which to me is one of the funniest things I've ever heard.
Yeah.
If I was the lawyer who would be afraid of litigating with you and your team, I would really hate to be the psychiatrist who would have to determine, because you're very, very grounded. I mean, you're very, you don't strike anybody as I mean, how can I? I would say you strike everybody as quite stable. So I can't imagine the poor psychiatrist who would have to do this.
Yes. Well, you know, they went after the psych exam. You see, this is an organization where people don't fight back because it's just too darn expensive, even for a doctor.
Right. Right.
So they went after the psych exam because that enabled them to really beat me up. So they immediately had to send my name to the National Practitioner Data Bank, which means it's almost impossible for me to ever get a job or a license in another state.
Right. And it well, also, but the other thing is they can, because there's been a huge media effort on this, which is national, if not international, and they can say, oh, she needs a psych exam, right? Right. Exactly. So that's great. If you're the San Francisco Chronicle, you know, you can use that, right?
Precisely. I mean, press releases were sent out about me. I have no idea. I mean, I don't think a board sends out press releases, but some
you had no idea the Maine Medical Board had clout at Reuters and with the in the international global media conglomerate.
Exactly. I mean, the stories made it sound as if I was either a substance abuser or completely nuts. And so by ordering that psych eval, they were able to give the files of my case to the press and allow that kind of...
Oh, you're kidding. No. How does ordering a psych evaluation authorize them to share your files with the media?
I mean, I don't know, but that's how it works. That's the regulation. So that's why they did it. You know, they did it in order to make a bigger point of me, to, you know, use me as a poster child and scare the rest of the doctors throughout the country. That was the plan, obviously. But, you know, so we said, wait a minute, you've got no grounds. You don't just get to sort of order psych exams on people for no reason. So, and we pointed out that the statutes they were using were unconstitutional besides. And so if we go to court, and so we filed in court, we're not going to fool with the board anymore. I mean, this board voted unanimously to take away my license, knowing nothing about the situation. And without me even being given the opportunity to say a single word to them.
Normally, in my experience, there's an investigation.
Yeah, but they did the investigation, which doesn't include me. You know, so they subpoenaed the records of these patients. They looked at my website, you know, and that was the investigation.
It's very Bolshevik. It's the only way. Bolshevik. Yeah, this is the most Bolshevik thing I've heard of coming out of Maine, I must say. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Well, again, we are not living by the rule of law.
Right.
And I have to admit, so they were angry at me before, you know, anything happened, because I had been emailing them, and the executive director and other members of the board staff. I said, you know, will you please specify what misinformation and disinformation is? And of course they can't. Nobody.
All right.
No, it's impossible, right? Because if you said what disinformation, misinformation were, Fauci and Rochelle Walensky would be guilty of it.
Right.
Because they've
right.
told the story so many times. So they can't write that down, but they want it to be a crime, but they can't, it's not really a crime. And I kept saying, okay, what statute are you working from, and define this for me? And why can't I use these licensed drugs? And so they were going bullshit because they had no answer.
Right.
And so eventually they just wanted to destroy me and make all this go away.
Right. Right. So you use the atom bomb of suspending you. The problem is now you're fighting. Now, right. When you litigate, who are you? Who's on the other side? It's the
right.
board on the other side.
The board, yes, the board and the board staff, basically, are the defendants.
Now, are they using internal counsel or external counsel?
So, because they're part of the Department of Health and Human Services of Maine, they have all these little assistant attorney generals
okay.
to use. So they have, you know, litigating attorney generals and other attorney generals, and, you know, they have quite a big staff. I don't think the staffing is the problem for them. They probably have enough people. However, I'm not sure they want to lose their statutes. They have these poorly written statutes that won't stand up to scrutiny. And
right.
if they go away, their powers in the future will be limited, and their reputations, because this board has three lawyers at least on the staff.
Right.
And how did these lawyers miss the fact that these statutes are unconstitutional? You know, how did they allow these things to happen? So the reputation of these staffers is going to go, you know, down the tubes if they allow this to go to litigation.
So,
and I'm, they do.
I have one of the most interesting things that's happened to me over the last 2 years is I have subscribers and people in my network who are nurses or doctors who find themselves having a war in the middle of the hospital because someone is doing something to their patient that they believe will kill them because it's, I forget, is it the FDA, the CDC schedule? In other words, the government is issuing orders about how somebody must be treated, you know, like an algorithm. And they, as a doctor or nurse, know that if you do those things, that person will die. And exactly. So there's a war between the CDC dictate and, you know, common sense, which brings us to our, you know, the most important thing we have to talk about here, which is the doctor-patient relationship. And what we're talking about is a global political coup being able to dictate to a series of different government regulatory structures down to the main medical board, basically saying that that they can destroy your fiduciary obligation to your patient.
Yes. Okay. So normally what happens in medicine is the CDC, if any agency does it, it's the CDC will issue guidelines for treatment, and they're only guidelines. They're not cast in stone.
Right.
And professional organizations like a group of internists or Johns Hopkins doctors or some other group may issue guidelines, and it can go on a website and people can look at the guidelines and see if they like them or not. And that's how things were always done. And, you know, if you want to play it safe, you follow the guidelines that are out there, the most prominent ones. For instance, there's specific guidelines about whether you have pneumonia that you got as an outpatient or whether you have in-hospital-based pneumonia because there's different organisms, how you would treat before you know which microorganism it is, et cetera. These are all from guidelines. But if you're better than the guidelines, if you have ample reason to make another decision, you can do so as a doctor. There's no law that says you have to follow guidelines, or there never has been. Of course, right. This is another thing that's happened quietly without a law, but it's been imposed secretly, and in part through financial incentives. So what happened with the pandemic is something new. The CDC didn't issue guidelines. They just said, do what the NIH says. And NIH created a guidelines panel for treatment of COVID. And there are three co-chairs, and one is Clifford Lane, who is one of Fauci's capos. And they have been issuing guidelines which have been, they would like everyone to think are cast in stone. And they are supposed to look at all the evidence and come up with a reasonable answer. So they look at vaccines, they look at ivermectin, they look at hydroxychloroquine, et cetera. But the guidelines out of this group, which, by the way, the membership has changed a lot over time, and they were selected by the three co-chairs, the guidelines are useless. They're basically remdesivir, you know, no hydroxychloroquine, no ivermectin. And they fly in the face of the existing literature. And then, you know, people in the government have to, or their lackeys have to come up with reasons why we're ignoring the medical literature. So at the moment, even though everybody's in favor of inclusivity and diversity and equity, all the medical literature that comes from South America, Asia, et cetera, is being dumped. They're saying, we can't trust it. You know, it's not coming out of Oxford. It's not coming out of Harvard. It's coming out of these third world or second world countries. So we're ignoring it, which is amazing, right?
Wow.
We're supposed to, everything is about equity now, except it isn't. So there are 300 papers on hydroxychloroquine for COVID, and there's over 70 papers for ivermectin for COVID. Most of these are coming from small countries because guess what? Those are the few countries where it hasn't been suppressed.
Right.
All right. So NIH
says... But they're all coming from real experience.
Real experience. Right? Lots of patients. I mean, I think in all the hydroxychloroquine papers, there may be 500,000 people that got it. I mean, these right. are, and so 90% of them are favorable to the drug. There's right. no question. But this guidelines panel, or maybe the guidelines panel isn't making the decisions because it's not clear. Someone has filed suit to try to get information on how the ivermectin decisions went down, because it doesn't seem like the guidelines panel may have actually met about it, or maybe some little subset. And among this very small subset, somebody got a $50 or $100 million grant shortly afterwards. yeah. So the Fauci method, the carrot and the stick, a very rich carrot or a very nasty stick. Lose your reputation or get overpaid. It turned out that on that guidelines panel, 16 of the members had a recent or past financial involvement with Gilead, the maker of remdesivir. Mm. And remdesivir is the competition to hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin, or was.
And very expensive competition.
And very expensive and dangerous. Now we have Paxlovid, which is also competition, which is the Pfizer drug. And then we have the bad Merck drug that nobody wants to use. So how has that been enforced in the hospitals? It's not clear, but hospitals were given a financial. So no, practically no one else in the world besides the United States uses remdesivir because it doesn't work. It doesn't reduce hospital length of stay, which was the basis upon which it was initially authorized and then approved. And it causes renal insufficiency and sometimes kills your kidneys. So, the treatments that are you don't realize how much can be done with peer pressure. I'm sure the doctors in the hospitals weren't told we're going to get, $5,000 or $10,000 more for each remdesivir patient. Right. You do. But the electronic medical record pops up, and if you write the patient has COVID, the first thing that you see is remdesivir. And right. you're supposed to click on it, right? Now, if you don't click on it, because this is all electronic, somebody's able to count what you're clicking on, right. or the nurses can report you, or something right. else. You develop an institutional culture where everybody has to do the same thing. And right. it's very effective, especially when you have the mainstream media paying national attention to these doctors who tried something else, like me. You get them all scared. See, once you go after a doctor's license, that's it. That doctor either has to give in and do whatever they tell that person, and it'll usually cost them a lot of money besides, because they'll have to pay for counseling and they'll have to pay for monitors of their practice. And it's a terrible, thing for a doctor. Or they'll lose their life and lose their career.
You're looking at setting up a financial incentive system for the hospitals and the medical system, where if you play ball, you make a lot of money. If you don't play ball, you can be destroyed.
Exactly.
And the problem is, if you play ball, and I'll say these are my words, increasingly you're helping implementing a genocide system.
Correct.
I mean, you're killing people who don't need to die.
That's right. But you're not acknowledging it, right? Because they're dying of COVID. They're not dying of remdesivir.
Right.
Right?
Right.
So you've got this whole sort of groupthink established, and you have a way of explaining these deaths, and everyone's doing the same thing. So you can't get in trouble. So malpractice is only an issue. You can only be sued for malpractice if the standard of care you're using is different from what everyone else is doing. If everyone else is doing the same thing,
right. Yeah, now you see, it's interesting. You see the same thing happening in investment advisory, or in accounting and CPAs. You have this intercession of a political machinery into the expert-client relationship or expert-patient relationship, and suddenly, everybody's cash flow depends on playing ball with the political machine, and then it's a downward spiral. So we've seen judges intercede across the country and say, okay, you've got to make ivermectin available. But I was just looking at your wonderful website and realizing we've now seen several AGs, and now the South Carolina AG intercede and say the medical boards can't do this.
Yes. Right. So finally, there's some momentum starting to understand what's this. I didn't get a patient relationship much, but government has interceded itself, and government in cahoots with the medical pharmaceutical industries, the hospital industry, and the medical health insurance industries, inserted themselves in between the doctor and the patient, and they now are going to call the shots, tell you what you must do for this patient and what you're not able to do anymore. Right. And so even though the patient is paying for the care, because it's all the money is traveling through third parties, the patient and the doctor have no control. The third parties have the control. Right. So it's an interesting system. If we got rid of health insurance, all of this could end in a second. But meantime, the government is taking over healthcare. Now, how big is healthcare? Healthcare is 20% of GDP.
Right.
That's almost $4 trillion a year. So if government can tell you how that money is going to be spent in favored industries, on favored drugs, et cetera, you know, our ability to have choice and autonomy of our healthcare completely goes away, but we're still paying through the nose for this lousy, you know, government-imposed healthcare.
Right. Now, tell me about this, the South Carolina AG's opinion. What is the South Carolina AG done?
Okay. So the South Carolina, Oklahoma, and Nebraska attorney generals have all basically issued an opinion that gives safe harbor to doctors and patients to use drugs for COVID, including hydroxychloroquine, chloroquine, and ivermectin, as they wish, as long as there is informed consent and these are used in appropriate ways, you know, not overdosed or, you know, checking for drug interactions, you know, standard good medical practice. Doctors cannot, the medical boards have been explicitly told you cannot go after doctors for doing this. Right. The Nebraska Attorney General opinion came out, it's the oldest, October 15. It's 41 pages. It is a beautiful document to read, because not only does it go over all the scientific evidence on safety and efficacy of these drugs, but it explains why the opinions that have come out of the NIH, CDC, FDA, and even the WHO fly in the face of the evidence.
Right.
So it disputes their conclusions. It shows that they are nonsense, and it provides a roadmap for the other states to do the same thing.
Right. So, and that's, you know, I have to say, facts matter. It can take a long time and it can take a lot of patience to fight, but facts really do matter.
Thank you. Yeah, absolutely. Eventually, you know, the problem with medicine and healthcare is that you have to know a lot to be able to understand what's going on. And they've made things so darn complicated. The heart, you know, you, like me, you have to have worked in a hospital. You have to sort of know how the system operates, because it's not written down anywhere.
Yeah, but that's why, you know, I just have to go back to you and your website and the work that you do to help us all understand what's going on. You know, I dare say when you first started to push back about what was happening with the anthrax vaccine, you had no idea how bad the corruption was, because it's hidden behind this world of complexity. And it takes years to unpack the complexity. But now that you have unpacked that complexity and we truly understand the model, you know, that knowledge, that intelligence is very powerful. You know, and that's why I'm so glad to see you litigating this. I know it's a huge job. I'm so glad to see you litigating this, because if we don't defend the doctor-patient relationship, we're not going to have healthcare. We're going to have whatever you want to call, you know, the Fauci. We're going to have Fauci poisoning, or whatever you want to call it. You know, so do you want to have a doctor and a relationship with your doctor, or do you want to just get poisoned by Fauci's algorithm du jour?
Exactly.
That's,
I mean,
this.
We don't know what they're up to. And, you know, if we go along, and this has been, you know, brought in so gradually by HMOs and other things.
Right.
So your employer pays for a certain kind of insurance, and then you have to only go to doctors who take that insurance, you know, and
right.
And so we have been conditioned to go along with many aspects of, you know, third party payer influenced healthcare. Even wealthy people now don't know where to go. Nobody,
right.
You know, I get calls constantly from people saying, you know, where can I find a doctor? Recommend a doctor to me. And I'm like, I don't know where to find a doctor. I don't even know who's going to be my doctor, because the fact that they've all gone along with it, not all, but almost all doctors
right.
have gone along with this thing is so frightening.
It's, you know, very frightening.
What do they go along with next? Don't they realize what's happening? But again, you know, they have a mortgage, they have children. What are they going to do?
Right. But, well, because there's always something to do. You know, when I said, no, I'm not going along, it looked hopeless. But I said, there's always something to do. There has to be a way. I turned to my attorney, said, you know, we're going to have to find a way to support ourselves at retail. We're going to have to work for individuals because we can't work for big corporations and governments anymore. And she turned to me and she looked at me and she said, good luck with that, honey. But we just said there has to be a way. We'll just, you know, we'll figure out how to be useful, and we'll just keep being useful, and we'll see if we can find a pathway. Because you can't make money doing genocide. That's not a business. That's not a future.
Right.
That's not, who wants to do that? That's no fun. So I can't imagine being a doctor and having to give somebody some protocol that's going to kill them. It's just...
But remember, in order for them to put one foot in front of the other, they can't believe it.
Right. 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 But that's getting more and more uncomfortable. I don't know if you've seen, I sent you a link to Dr. Skidmore's survey, which he's now published. And I just think it's going to get harder and harder in the face of the facts for doctors to pretend that there's not a real serious disconnect between politically driven motivation from Washington and the regulatory structure, you know, and what they're seeing on the ground. So it's coming to a head now. Okay, so what can we do to support you? How, because you're really fighting this fight for all of us and our right to have, you know, decent health care, because we all need help with our health care one way or another. So we need to have doctors that we can trust. We need experts who can trust us and we can trust. You need to have that relationship. How do we support you in fighting this fight?
Well, so financially, if you donate to Children's Health Defense, that and by, you know, it's for my, to help my defense, that'd be great. But what we really need, so there was Lyme disease 20, 30, 40 years ago, and the federal government said there is no chronic Lyme, and doctors
right.
who treated Lyme over 40 had their licenses taken away. And nobody in New England could find a doctor to treat them with chronic Lyme. And they went to the legislatures. And eventually, every single state in New England passed a law saying doctors do not have to treat Lyme according to the CDC guidelines. My
wow.
state was passed. And we passed that law in 2015. And that gave safe harbor to the doctors and the patients. And so now they can be treated for Lyme. We need to do that for ivermectin hydroxychloroquine, but we need to do something bigger, which is that the medical boards, you know, the government doesn't get to interfere. If it's a licensed drug, you know, if the patient wants it and the doctor wants to give it and it has a license, there should be no restrictions. You know, the
right.
The FDA has the right to restrict the use of medications. They can put a black box warning. They can take it off the market. That requires data. That requires a process and a paper trail.
Right.
If the drug is no good, let FDA go through the process and take it away. If it's a good drug, you know, for whatever the indications are, you need to be able to use it. And so you have to stop these sort of internecine mechanisms that restrict people for political reasons. You know, we don't know what was going on with Lyme disease, but now there's a couple of books that suggest that the outbreak of Lyme disease may have been related to, you know, escape from military laboratories. And so right. maybe the need to cover up the fact that there was chronic Lyme disease had to do with the fact that the government released it by right. mistake. And the same thing with this pandemic. You know, how much did the government know? Did the government release it by mistake? Maybe even deliberately somewhere? You know, why were we working along with the Chinese to develop these kinds of organisms? You know, what?
Right.
We're not supposed to do, they're supposed to be our enemy, not our helper in developing biological weapons, which, by the way, is against the law.
Well, but if you look at the biological weapon labs and industry and funding all around the world, it's very significant and very hard to get good disclosure and information on.
Absolutely. You can build your own biosafety lab, 3 or 4, and you can do whatever you want in it. Really, that, you know, these private labs are not being checked.
Wow.
So that's a whole nother thing, which, you know, I can get into at another time. But for right now, we are, much of what is regulating everything in our lives is related to emergency rules and regulations, right. which were triggered by statements about the pandemic. If the pandemic is no longer an emergency, if we don't need vaccine mandates and we don't need masks, it's not an emergency. We need to get rid of those laws. And then our legislatures need to vote those laws out, get them off right. the book. And by the way, these laws were initiated by the CDC,
right,
which paid to have a model Emergency Health Powers Act developed and then took it to all the states to get them to adopt it. And so we have to get rid of emergency regulations. You know, we have to figure out how to make our politicians accountable, identify what they've done, what they haven't done. You know, this never can happen again.
Well, the reality is, you know, we did a big paper last year on taxation. We're financing criminal enterprise by government. And we've got to find a way to shift that money back into lawful purposes. You know,
absolutely.
That's part of it. Yeah, that's
absolutely.
Part of it.
I mean, the government has found so many ways to steal our money and use it against us.
Right.
You know, to create biological weapons, for example.
Well, my concern is they have used the pandemic to create, you know, they've been building a financial control grid for decades. And they use that control grid to help engineer this pandemic. But they've used the pandemic to tighten that financial control grid. You see what happened with the truckers in Canada. It's a perfect example. And the question is, how do we turn it around? My fear is if they get that control grid to snap in place, like the Chinese social credit, then they can mandate whatever they want, no matter how crazy it is, because they've got you in the corner.
Yes.
And that's got to be stopped. So,
yeah.
And I think the state AGs and the state legislatures are one of the critical places to do that. So I really appreciate the work that you and Children's Health Defense have done there, because I think it's one of the places where we can make a big, big difference right now.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely.
Okay. Well, Meryl Nass, I just have to say you're a national and international treasure. So when are you coming back to Europe next?
Good question. I'm going to have to get my passport renewed.
Oh, Lord. Anything else you want to say before we close? Again, thank you from the bottom of our hearts for doing this, because, you know, this is... in terms of staying healthy, having that person you can trust to help you is so very important. So I can't thank you enough. But anything else you want to say before we close?
I want to say there's a lot of laws on the books, and they're often contradictory. You know, we have this incredibly complicated system of laws in the United States at the state and federal level, and we need to go through them. We need to pick through them and get rid of the bad ones.
Need to enforce the good ones.
And we need to enforce the good ones. We have a great constitution.
Right.
This country could be great again.
Right.
I'm not talking MAGA. If we simply went back rule of law.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. So when somebody tells me we need to make new laws, I say, no, we need to enforce the good laws we have.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
Right. Well, so, you certainly are standing up for them. So I can't thank you enough, Dr. Merrill Nass. You keep us posted on what we can do to help. Tell everybody again your website, which is a treasure chest.
Thank you. So anthraxvaccine.blogspot.com and a mirror site at merrillnassmd.com. And I just started a Substack at merrillnass.substack.com. I want to tell you one more thing. Uh-huh. Google, for the first time ever, took down one of my posts on my Google blog. I gotta tell you what the post was. It's not anything you would imagine. It had nothing to do with vaccines, ivermectin, or the pandemic. What it was I took, I showed that language that Joni Mitchell had used, and then language that Neil Young had used in their statements against Joe Rogan, used exactly the same phrases and images and ideas as something that Peter Daszak had written 2 years ago. And I said, this is propaganda. This is trying to cause you to believe that these people are on the side of the good guys, the other side is the other, you know, they have that they have global support, that blah, blah. And the language was
so striking. My question is, did you offend the copywriters at Hill and Knowlton?
Suggested that maybe what is it called, the biggest PR firm in the world might have had something, Eddington, something like that.
See, my bet was on Hill and Knowlton, but it's maybe the Hill same idea, right?
Exactly. And I said, I bet the same PR people wrote these two scripts. They're 2 years right. apart, about completely right. different subjects.
Right, exactly.
That was the one post they couldn't let stand.
Yep. It kind of says it all. It's a wag the dog. It's
yes.
wag the dog. Okay. Dr. Merrill Nass, you have a great day. We predict great things ahead, and you keep us posted on what we can do to support. And I do want to say to everybody, because I say it all the time, you know, if you don't have an army to protect your assets, you won't have assets. So go over to Children's Health Defense and make a donation. They're doing great things.
Yeah. And yes. run for office. Run for
and
office.
Run for, yes, run for office. Run locally. Okay, you have a great day, Marilla. Thank you again.
Bye, Catherine.
Bye.